Hello again, everybody, and welcome back to the Three Inning Save podcast. I'm your host, Eric Steven. We've been off a few weeks. Most of it was due to scheduling conflicts between myself and Jacob Birch. But most importantly, Jacob and his wife welcomed a new child into the world recently. Jacob reported that both mom and baby are doing well, and he's going to be back shortly. But for today, it's just me and the host chair, but I am not alone on the podcast. I have with me today John Wiseman, creator of Dodger Thoughts and previous podcast guest, and he's currently writing about anything and everything at the Slade by Voices newsletter. John, how are you doing?
Good. Thanks, Eric. And passing along congrats to Jacob. It's wonderful.
Yeah, two kids now for them. So like that'll be fun. I'm sure he'll tell us stories about it when he's back. We'll see when that is. But yeah, for now, we're just a couple guys watching the Dodgers team that trying to figure out who they are, I think, or who we think they are. I don't know. But we'll talk a little bit more about that after the break.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Okay, so we're recording this on Sunday. It's before the final game of Dodgers-Padres. You'll certainly be listening to this after that game. We're about 5.5 weeks into the season. Entering today, the Dodgers are in first place in the National League West. They're half a game up on Arizona, two games up on the Padres. They are actually tied with the Pirates at 20-14 for the second best record in the National League. Only the Braves are better. But my question to you, and also maybe to me, is how do you think this season has gone so far? I know that's a very open-ended question, but it's just – It's hard to put my finger on like what is going on with this team just yet.
Well, those are two different questions.
Right.
I think I don't know how you can't be happy with a 20-14 record right now. Given the obvious concerns with the team and a season that really started with Gavin Lux's injury. I obviously you can factor everything from the offseason into it, but that was the moment where everything kind of went sideways in terms of an offseason plan. And you know, there was a moment a couple weeks ago where you thought the Dodgers might go the way the Cardinals are going right now. Cardinals have lost 8 in a row, I think. For that matter, the Pirates I think have lost 7 in a row. But anyway, I think if you're a Dodger fan, you might not be thrilled with exactly who's on your team, but you have to be thrilled with the record, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you're right. Like the Gavin Lux thing, it kind of just it made everything a lot more difficult, like what they were trying to do, right? Like Miguel Rojas seemed like a pretty good addition as like an extra guy in the infield. And then all of a sudden he's the regular shortstop. And then he's been so hurt in the first like month that he's not even that right now. Like he's back, but he's basically going to be probably two starts a week ish. Right. And then it's the roster is at the point where it actually makes sense to play Mookie Betts at shortstop, which seems absurd, but like given how the roster is like, it's just a very hard roster to figure out. There's a difference. Like expectations are weird because they're not a bad team. I don't know how good they're going to be, but like, yeah, 20-14, really good. And you just have to be sort of pleased with that. And you know, either they're going to figure it out as they are, or they're going to figure out what like changes they need to make at some point, I guess is how it goes. It could have been worse. I mean, as recently as like a week and a half ago, they were 13-13, right? They won 7 of 8, as we record now. So like a lot of that was getting Will Smith back. I believe he has played every game, since he's been back, either at catcher or DH. It helps to some extent that JD Martinez, the designated hitter, has been out. So it frees up that position for him when he's not catching. But the offense, there were times there when you had Smith out, and then I guess when they were in Pittsburgh, Muncy was out. The lineups were pretty rough there, you know. So it seems a little tougher for teams to pitch to at this point. So that's at least good.
I found it impossible to watch the Lakers in the playoffs right now and not think about the Dodgers. Now, I don't watch. It's not because of what I'm seeing on the court, but just in terms of the journey that I read about in the standings and in the personnel. The Lakers started their season 2-10. I think, pretty much remade their team almost entirely, except for like the core in the middle of the season. You guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's a vastly different team. And now they are 2 wins away from the conference finals.
Right.
They are, you know, considering they started 2-10, I think they've been probably a top 5 NBA team. And the Dodgers may be doing that. I mean, who knows? I mean, I can only stretch this analogy so far, but they may do that without a 2-10 start.
Yeah. Yeah, you could see that. And I think you tweeted something the other day, maybe it was yesterday, just pointing out, I think if they have Urias, Kershaw, Dustin May, and Tony Gonsolin, like if they're all healthy in the playoffs, like it's hard for that team to lose, right? Like,
I think it's hard for that team to lose 4 out of 7.
Exactly, that's what I meant. Yeah. And but also, they've also not had like their full complement of starters, I think, healthy going into a postseason since like 2020. So like that's gonna, you know, that'll be something to watch for sure. But we don't like they're so long between now and then. It's just funny. But I don't know. I find also, I don't know. I don't want to. I think sometimes the fan like complaining, it's not proportional to like how the team is actually playing sometimes. Like I just remember the back in the old days, I think my first year at True Blue LA was 2009, and that was a 95 win team. And the comments were just so bad sometimes. Like it got annoying, like to the point, like obviously, you know, I'd say built a good community and since then and stuff, but like it was very hard. Like I don't know, that I think that I let that stuff, or I used to let that stuff get to me more than it does now. I just find it more depressing, like just Twitter reactions and things like that. It's just, I think it's just generally overall negative. So it's like it makes going through like a a transition type year, even though it's not like maybe as extreme as I'm describing it. It just, it makes it like the even weirder to go through.
I've definitely gotten better at dealing with that stuff, mostly by the key to that, of course, is not initiating anything.
Yeah.
For example, that tweet I made yesterday about the four starters, if they pitch well, within 10 seconds, someone responded to me and said, LOL Kershaw in October. And I'm just like, why do I even speak? You know, I mean, I used to see it as my mission to correct those people.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, I mean, I embraced the role, but in some ways, I feel there are more people who, I do feel there are more people who have perspective, and also I feel like you realize there are people who are never going to have perspective, who are always going to live day to day, and it doesn't matter what they've seen. They may know on some level that it's only May. They may know on some level even that the Dodgers will make deadline deals, or probably will. They choose not to care.
Yeah.
And it's us.
I think Craig Goldstein has been sharing for a while. I think there's someone in the Baseball Prospectus comment section. It's been going on for a couple of years where anytime Clayton Kershaw is referred to as like a future Hall of Famer, he objects and like, I don't understand what you're talking about. Like, and it's okay. It's kind of funny because it's absurd, but at the same time, like, does he really think that? Is this a bit like, there's part of me that I'm like, it's distressing. And also like, maybe, you know, I haven't talked to Craig about this, but it's just like, maybe don't give that guy so much oxygen, you know, that kind of a thing.
Right.
Like, but I don't know. It's just, it's kind of a good bit, I guess, but like not nothing beyond that. I don't know. It's just weird. So we mentioned Dodgers won 7 of 8. I think the most, or the wildest game of that group was probably the Wednesday afternoon game. I saw you tweet about this, but so the Dodgers fell behind 5-0 in that game. They ended up winning on a grand slam by Max Muncy. Can you explain your process in following along with that game on Wednesday?
Yes. I was under the weather, basically taking a sick day, a real one. I know the line is sketchy now that we do a lot of working from home, but I actually did put my computer down and everything. And I had the TV on without the sound. So I was checking in on it. I mean, I was watching the first half of the game. I got a good look at the 5-0 part, and became more sleepy and as the Dodgers were coming back. And in it was 5-3 at one point, and then Dodgers got a run, and I believe Will Smith was up with a runner. I don't even know anymore, but tying runners on base. Two out. I believe it was Will Smith who made the last out. And as far as I knew, that was the ninth inning. And I was like, oh, ball game. That was too bad. And I rolled over. I shut off the TV and rolled over. I don't know why I thought it was the ninth inning. I mean, like, I just assumed it. It didn't help that I was watching the TV with my glasses off.
Oh.
It was all blurry. So all I could really see was, like, basic shapes and forms of outs being made. I rolled over, I slept, I woke up. I don't know, I saw some story on my feed saying Max Muncy's walk-off grand slam. At first I was like, just literally, what day is this? And I checked, I was in such a daze, I checked to see if it was April 1st. And it wasn't.
Man.
And then I thought, just like, what? Why did an old story run? And then I checked. I think I checked you guys next. I think I checked True Blue LA next. And it was like Muncy walk off grand slam. I'm like, what is going on? And then I looked and realized, and I checked. I was like, what was the Will Smith thing I saw? And it was the seventh inning. That's all I got. Like, they actually won. I slept through it. Good for them.
Yeah. I think the last game I can remember like that where I was fully kind of out of it was it reminded me this weekend because on Friday it was Clayton Kershaw and Yu Darvish against each other, and I think this was in this was in 2021. It was like a Saturday game in San Diego, so I was just home, but I think I got my the second vaccine shot that day, and like mm-hmm. I didn't experience any like side effects. This one I was just kind of tired, so at some point during the afternoon I said I'm gonna take a nap before the game, and then I was like recapping it that night, and next thing I know I woke up and it's like the fourth inning, and I had no same thing. I woke up, I don't know what day it is, I don't know what time it is, like I don't know where I am. It was just this, I was completely out of it, so it took me a little bit to get into it. I think that game was like a really good game. It was like I think very low scoring till like the end or something, but yeah, that was just maybe it's just that time of year for that kind of stuff. You mentioned we talked a little bit about how the Dodgers were how they're sort of doing that game. They scored 10 runs. It was their third straight game scoring in double digits. I just looked this up because I know it's come up a few times this year, but they have still not scored exactly 4 runs in a game this year.
That is the stat I always keep an eye on. The average team scores 4.5 runs a game, and the Dodgers have yet to score 4 in a game.
So through Saturday, only 4 teams had scored exactly four runs twice: Mariners, Padres, A's, and Astros. And no team had scored four runs once. So all 29 teams besides the Dodgers have scored at least 4 or scored 4 runs at least once. So they're an outlier right now. They're just avoiding that that 4-run mark. It's very weird.
I'm interrupting this broadcast with a breaking news alert.
Oh,
Hanser Alberto has 2 doubles and a homer today.
Oh man.
And is now slugging .583 this season.
Wow. So he made the White Sox as an on-roster invitee. I don't remember what his spring numbers were. He hit like something like over 400, I think, during spring. So I thought you were going to say honestly that like he was pitching, like, but that's
not breaking news.
No, exactly right. Yeah. That's like the first game I went to Coors Field. I don't remember the final, but all I remember was, well, Eric Gagne started for one thing, and I think he got into Joe Torre's doghouse that game. But Alex Cora homered twice and doubled, and the double was like off the wall, like high off the wall. So it was very much like that game. Speaking of roughly that era Dodgers, I have I saw a tweet on I think Saturday mentioned Mike Piazza meeting with Ted Williams. Piazza was drafted in the 62nd round in 1988 as a favor to Tommy Lasorda, who was a family friend of his dad. The Twitter account Baseball History Nut tweeted that video of Ted Williams giving a 15-year-old Piazza tips in like his homemade batting cage. But what got me was the tweet in question said Piazza was quote was drafted dead last, which is not true. He was the final Dodgers pick that year, but back then in the MLB draft it would go as long as needed. Teams could keep picking in each round, but once they stopped, their draft was over. So it just kind of went until it didn't. My question to you is twofold. How many players were drafted after Mike Piazza in 1988, and how many rounds did that draft last? And I will give you some time because we're going to take a break and we will get your answers after this.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Okay, so Mike Piazza, he was the 1390th pick in the 1988 draft, second or 62nd round. My question to John is, how many how many players were drafted after Mike Piazza in the 1988 draft, and how many rounds did the draft last?
Okay, one thing I can say with confidence is that the 87 Dodgers, wait, you said 88 draft, right?
88, yep.
The 87 Dodgers were like 73 and 89, so the Dodgers would have been drafting near the beginning of the round.
Yeah.
The other thing I'm going to go with is that the 62nd round was the last round, which I'm slightly less confident about, but I'm going to do that. And I'm going to say that now I'm picking a random number, but it's going to be a random number between 1 and 20 at least.
Sure.
And I'm going to say, I'm going to say 12 players were drafted after Piazza.
12. Okay. I can tell you, no, there, it went a lot farther than I thought as well. But let's see. So there were, 43 players drafted after Mike Piazza,
oh, wow.
Amazingly. And it went to the 75th round. So in the 62nd round, there were only six teams still picking. Piazza was drafted as a first baseman. So I looked these up. It got down to the 75th round was just the Yankees. The Blue Jays and Yankees were going for a little bit as just two teams only for a while. And then the Blue Jays dropped out after the 73rd round, and then they picked two more players. But I rounded up. So of the 43 after Piazza, only 10 signed that year. 19 never played, like, even in the minors. One player played just in independent ball only. 10 were drafted again. I think the highest was in the second round in 1991. So 3 years later, Jim Lewis by the Blue Jays, he made AAA. He was one of four players drafted after Piazza to make it to AAA. None made the majors. One made AA, and 13 made A ball at some level. But
add some color to that, which is that in those days, it wasn't just that baseball didn't broadcast the draft. They didn't tell you who got drafted. I'm saying they literally didn't tell you. I started work at the LA Daily News in fall of 89. So 1990 was my first draft, and we literally had to get on the phone and call the high school players and coaches that we knew that might be drafted and ask them if they were drafted.
Wow.
Mike Lieberthal was a first round draft choice, either in 90 or 91. He was the Daily News Player of the Year. He was a first round pick, and we only found out that the Phillies drafted him by a phone call between the two of us.
Wow. That's wild. I remember.
Can you imagine round 73?
No. I just remember, you know, using like newspapers.com or like LA Times Archive or something. And you look back and it's like there would be like little, it would be a small item in a notes notes section at the end of like a beat report for maybe two sentences. And it would be like maybe like a week or two after the draft, like, oh, the Dodgers brought in, you know, so-and-so who they drafted in the first round. You know, it's just like there's no like immediacy to it or anything. That is kind of wild.
What a time.
Yeah. Clayton Kershaw was drafted, you know, slightly higher than Mike Piazza several years later, born in 1988. So he was around when Mike Piazza was drafted. But
of course.
So I was thinking about this. I don't think it's a stretch to call you and I the two foremost connoisseurs of Clayton Kershaw's career whip. I think that's a fair statement. Do you remember when it first like caught your eye that he was like, or just paying attention to that at all? Like,
no, I don't remember. I mean, I mean, it's so odd that we started looking at his career numbers at such a young age for him.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were times when he was just like, I mean, he still, I think, has the number one ERA among starting pitchers, possibly, over a certain number of innings. Or is it either him or Pedro Martinez, I think. But
yeah, like in the live ball era, I think you're probably right.
Yeah. So it's not like this. I mean, he's been so fantastic for such a long time. There was that era for many years where he always ended up with a lower ERA than when he started the ERA. I can't speak. He always ended with a lower career ERA than the year before. I think that went on for like.
I think it was like, it was a long stretch for sure.
So at some point, I don't think it was that. I don't think it was that much of a thing to search for.
Right.
But then as time passed and it became more of a fascinating thing, because the more innings you got, you know, the harder it is to get, especially as he sort of moved past the peak of his career. And he also seems to go back and forth. Like that Mach 1 is a real barrier for him, like to keep dancing on either side of it. And I think that adds to the fascination. I mean, the last start where, I mean, he really had built up quite an advantage going into that last start against San Diego, and then he gave up 13 base runners.
Yeah.
And boy, now he's back to, I think, 1.01, and we're back charging up the mountain again. It is fascinating.
Yeah, you're right. Like, especially like in the last year or so, we would either text or DM each other, like, if he just gets these three outs, he's at one, you know, and then like something will trickle through, or something with two outs, and then it was just kind of funny how that played out. But so I don't remember exactly when I sort of stumbled on it either. I think I first wrote about it in 2017, and I was also I don't consider myself like a, at least I don't know. Like, I'm probably too hard on myself, but like, I am not the best or at like all the time at answering questions. I just try to do like, find like interesting stuff. And like, after a start is usually not the best time to ask weird stuff. Though I think I asked it one of the starts, he like went under one.
Oh my God. You asked him.
He had like the stock answer of like, you know, it's something I think about when my career's done, that kind of a thing. But like, I just remember what a terrible time to ask that question. Towards the end of this month, he's gonna come up on his 40,000th pitch, and I have not done any research on where that stands. And there's also, it's hard finding like pitch data over a certain period. But I was thinking more of modern pitchers, but I've been meaning to go up. I haven't talked to him about it yet, but like just to get his perspective on that. I want to find out how, like, I wonder if he has an estimate of how many pitches he's thrown like in between starts to add to that, you know, like, cause I just happened to notice that he's like 39,600 or something right now. And that just seems like an inordinate amount of pitches to me. I'm sure there's obviously a lot, there's pitchers with a lot more, but like that just seems like a crazy number of pitches to throw.
All right. I'm going to give, this isn't exactly what we were talking about.
Yep.
But on July 8th, 2010, I tweeted, Clayton Kershaw now has a lower whip and higher K9 than Tim Lincecum. And he's 4 years younger.
Wow.
I don't even know what that's supposed to mean. But.
I think maybe at the time, so you, at that point, right, Lincecum had the two Cy Youngs, and then it was like, should the Dodgers have drafted Lincecum, because they were, they could have added him to their like playoff ready teams earlier. That was sort of the rationale, right? Like, or at least the more plausible why didn't the Dodgers draft Waka over Seager thing? You know, like, yeah, but no, that's wild. Sort of similarly,
April 15th, 2017, Clayton Kershaw's WHIP is in its sixth straight season of decline and approaching 1.000 for his career.
Wow.
So we're on the same. If that's 2017, I think we're on in the same timeline.
Yeah. Basically. So he got it. So his first start, he was exactly at one. Obviously, no one was asking him about it at that point. Six innings. But so he got under one a couple starts ago. So he was under for two starts this year. He's been under one after 10 career starts. But before that, it was September of 2018. And then but he's been exactly one five starts. So 15 starts out of 408 games. So that's pretty wild. But you mentioned WHIP too. Like, I think I don't know exactly where he's at. I think he's either third or fourth at the moment, all time. But that includes like two dead ball era guys and Jacob DeGrom. And if you look, DeGrom is like 3 months younger than Kershaw, and Kershaw has like double the innings. So like, it's pretty wild what he's sort of done.
It's a controversial take, but what do you think of WHIBIP, which is walks, hits, hit by pitches per innings pitched? I mean, you know.
Oh, wow. We need to work on the acronym, but like, obviously there are other, yeah, anything, you know, that can sort of actually, you know, drill deeper into like, you know, what a pitcher's doing, it would probably be better. I just think it's, you know, I think it's more of a quirk than anything. It's not but it does show, like, it is pretty remarkable that I think his, I don't, renaissance is not the right word. He's just like maintained a level of excellence for a long time, even as a slightly different pitcher, maybe. And that has been kind of remarkable to watch. Like he going into Friday start, or I guess I don't know when Zach Gallen pitched exactly, but at the end of April, he led the National League in innings. I would have bet money that something like that wouldn't have happened again, you know, like at least in that amount of time, like a whole month, right? That's just not how he's used, not how I just didn't expect something like that to happen. And it's been kind of wonderful to see. Yeah, that's what a great transition I have here. So the Dodgers and Padres, they split the first two games, then they play again next weekend. I mean, obviously they are important games. It's weird because they're certainly important for, you know, just from a standing standpoint. Like the Padres are going to be the Dodgers' greatest competitor in the West, all due respect to the Diamondbacks, who I think are good, but probably not going to be division winning good. But and just how last season ended, probably, you know, has the Dodgers, like, probably, you know, wanting to win those, or at the same time knowing that even if they win these games, it still doesn't matter unless they do it in October. So, like, I don't know. I find it hard to, like, I don't know how to process like this anymore. Like, it's been so long. Like, I don't want to feel so to the point where, oh, regular season doesn't matter, because I don't think that's true at all. I just think sometimes that I find the reactions to things maybe more, I don't know, just a lot to take. But they're certainly like important series, but I don't know. I guess I don't know how important.
Well, there are going to be some people who say every game counts.
Yeah.
And speaking as someone who, I value the regular season, I think, as much as anyone.
Yeah.
I really do. I really think I've staked my territory on that. Although I value Kershaw more than I value the regular season. So it really has come to that for me. It's really, to me, Kershaw doing well as a Dodger is really my primary fan interest right now. It's sort of bizarre, I know, but it's true. Dodgers are second in that. And no, I'm not going to – we're a half an hour game away from that game starting. I'm not going to lose any sleep over the result.
Yeah.
And nor will – I mean, I'll be happy if the Dodgers leave with a road series victory. You know, I think that's,
sure.
I mean, that's good. If they don't, whatever. If they lose, if they start the season 1-5 against the Padres, well, I mean, we do have last season to look back on. It's,
yeah,
it has made it, it's a bit sad, you know, that it doesn't matter enough. I think the Dodgers front office has kind of leaned into it. They've chased being the best team through September in the hopes that would yield a payoff. For the most part, it hasn't, because that's the way life goes. And it doesn't mean they had to choose some of the decisions they made this past offseason, but it doesn't, they're certainly valid. But yeah, I mean, fans are gonna go nuts. It doesn't bother me that if a Padres fan put up the crying Kershaw image, I'd be like, yeah, that's par for the course.
Right.
The thing that bugged me about it was Padres social, not just Padres social media, but literally the Padres on their scoreboard doing it. To me, that's honestly, it's contemptible. And it totally shows a lack of perspective. And fine, they want to lean into their fan base and get them all excited and, you know, whatever. That's how it's going to go. But that was really a get-a-grip moment for the Padres. People are saying what the Dodgers do, you know, the Dodgers will get back at them next time Kershaw beats them. But, like, there's a lot of things you might be able to say about the Dodgers, but they would never do something like that on their scoreboard, ever.
Yeah, I could see. Yeah, the most they'll do, at least this year now, is a very bizarrely timed light show.
Yes.
Like they've had a few snafus with that. But yeah, I agree. That was like, that was over the top. Now, obviously, it's on the Petco Park scoreboard. So it is the Padres who did that, right? Like, now there are obviously different levels of people doing different things. But still, that had to, like, I would go through at least a couple of layers of approval to, like, get that up, right, on the scoreboard.
It's like, you know, there's a difference between someone going rogue,
yeah,
and putting up a cry. Like, first of all, they had to make it, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
It didn't just come out of nowhere. It didn't come out of someone's, they actually had to make it. But then, like, compare that to Fred Clare going rogue and saying, Rick Monday, you made a great play. Like, there's two different levels here, and I would rather be on the Dodgers side of that yeah, boundary.
Yeah, and I'm sort of glad I saw the reaction. Like, Kershaw didn't really bite on it, and he was just like, hey, you got to pitch better. You know, that was mostly the gist of it. And so I'm glad it didn't become more of a thing outside of that one instance.
But yeah, sorry, I circumvented your original point, but yeah, I've made it a policy that, you know, I'm disappointed in the loss and then I move on quickly.
Yeah.
And, nothing about it being the Padres will change that until there's a really tangible, clear impact on how things are going to go. And frankly, that's not going to happen until the playoffs. You know,
like, yeah.
I mean, when you can be the sixth best team in the NL and win an NL pennant like the Phillies did, you know, you got to make the most of the moment. You got to enjoy the good moments and just let the rest go. Life's too short.
Yeah, the season and life is too short, but also the season is very long. And yeah, like you just got to, it's a long trip and you have to, like, look at things along the pathway, right? Like, it's not just where you're going, it's how you got there and, like, that sort of thing. Like, And I think people lose sight of that sometimes. I thought this quote, this is from Max Muncy. Jack Harris in the LA Times wrote a sort of preview piece before the Dodgers-Padres series. And this is what Muncy said, quote, "I think we learned the lesson that you have to learn how to play with emotion. During the regular season, we've always been so successful because we stay level-headed throughout the entire thing. You can't play 162 with emotion, but when we reach the playoffs, we have trouble flipping the switch." Now, I sort of get what he's saying there, but like, I don't, that seems like a very loose way of describing like how the Padres played too. Like I don't think it was a lack of emotion. They just like didn't hit with runners in scoring position. Yeah, the Dodgers, right?
Like, I kind of hate when players say stuff like that. I mean, first of all, just giving the fans all the ammunition in the world to then throw those charges around everywhere. But you're exactly right. I find it hard to believe that the Dodgers went up to the plate with runners on base and didn't feel enough emotion. I find it real even harder to believe that Yency Almonte pitched in the bottom of the seventh inning of game four without enough emotion. You know, it's really kind of after the fact diagnosis. I can't tell you how the Dodgers were feeling individually at each moment, but even if they say they weren't feeling their best, I don't understand it. I mean, I guess I'll never understand this whole idea that it must be an emotional failure. If you lose the Dodgers, there was a headline somewhere about the Dodgers today after the 2-1 victory last night, saying Dodgers show grit in beating the Padres. And I'm like, literally one swing of the bat.
Yeah. They scored two runs in each of the two games against the Padres. And that was the one they won. Yeah.
Right.
The grit of having Dustin May throw six shutout innings.
Well, the grit of having, the grit of having Chris Taylor homer for the one hit off Blake Snell, and then the bottom of the ninth, I don't know. It's funny. I've been kind of, in the earlier days of Dodger thoughts, I really was hard into winning breeds chemistry, and chemistry was just kind of a non-existent thing that people made up after the fact. And I don't think the same way now. I do think players can help each other.
Sure.
Beyond what you see statistically. I mean, in other words, it will always be manifested statistically in wins and losses. But you can bring in a player let's say Hanser Alberto, although I don't really know, but who doesn't produce anything, but can maybe he did have an impact on somebody. I don't know. I'm willing to go that far. I'm not willing to go as far and say, oh, they lost because they didn't feel enough emotion.
They didn't have Hanser Alberto on their postseason roster. Although I will say, but to your point on that, it was funny. I remember they left him off it because they had Miguel Vargas on. But I just remember when, I think the day of game one, when we were asking Dave Roberts about the roster, and it's like, well, if Alberto's off, can he still be on the bench or with the team? And Roberts like literally sighed and he goes, yes, thank goodness, because he wanted him there. It was just pretty funny. Speaking of Vargas and James Outman too, that's another thing, like sort of enjoy the process part. We have watching two rookies like being major like contributors for the Dodgers. Obviously Outman had the great April, and Vargas has been like steady-ish, but like hitting really well of late. They seem pretty committed to both of those guys. And I think maybe I wouldn't have expected that, especially like Outman seemed to be like like he was going to get crowded out, like on the roster at least, but he played so well during spring. And I think like the Lux injury certainly played into that, like opening up a spot, I think, for him, just given how they're using Chris Taylor. But yeah, like that, I think that's something to watch going forward. Have you, what have you sort of seen from both of those guys?
Well, first to, I feel like this is what a lot of Dodger fans always want them to do, which is put their faith in some young guys and accept the growing pains. Vargas comes with a higher prospect rating, and he's had a weird couple months, as you know, from injury and not being able to swing the bat and just taking walks during spring training, to then he got a second injury, and his numbers are weird. He went a long time before hitting a home run, but now he really seems to be hitting, basically, and more importantly, maybe holding his own at that position, second base. So I'm looking at the stats now. He's walked 18 times and struck out 23. I mean, that's what you want to see. I always bring the Joel Guzman test to these things, which is that if you're striking out 10 times for every walk, that's probably not going to be sustainable.
Yeah.
Then we come to James Out, and I try to be in the whole strikeouts don't matter camp for hitters, you know, but he's got 44 strikeouts in 34 games, and you know, Chris Taylor's running that territory. But it does concern me that I want to see him make another adjustment in general to be a little, I mean, I don't know, even know why I'm trying to poke holes in the guy. He's doing fantastic. And he actually continues to hit, even if he's not hitting, having two homer games like he did against the Cubs, he continues to hit. But I just wonder about whether his, the holes in him get a little bigger and a little bigger, and there starts to be real warning signs there. He has asked, again, he can play defense as far as I'm concerned, and he can run, and he can do things even when he's not slugging like crazy. But probably Vargas is going to be the better player by the end of the season. The only caveat to that is that I, one of the few times I was a guest on your podcast, I said Max Muncy had no hope. He had just come up from the Dodgers, had just called him.
Oh, man. Wow. 2018?
Yeah. And he was just, and they had some issues with the, someone was hurt. I was like, if you're leaning on Max Muncy as your fill-in, you're or something like that.
And I haven't looked at this recently, but I want, he's got to be like, he's, I would bet money he's still in the top 10, maybe top 5 for in the majors in hitting home runs, like since he was called up in 2018. Right. So that, like, what a run for him. That's another, I mean, is he still leading the majors in home runs today?
I think so.
Yeah. Like what a run for him. Like he's, it's good to see that he's healthy and like hitting again. Cause that was, it was such a rough go last year, like trying to sort of find his way. Like even once he was like healthier, you know, then you got to like completely find your swing again. That has to be like incredibly frustrating.
Yeah.
Like just, and we saw this obviously for years with like Cody Bellinger and stuff, but yeah, it's, I don't think anyone expects that, you know, baseball players are like linear and they just, this is what they do every year. I guess if you find a player like that, you hold on to them for dear life. But like, it's very difficult, like just to do anything and like just to keep any kind of success up is incredible. So like, I don't know. I think you just find ways to sort of appreciate it, I guess.
I've only seen this in one place, but you know, the turnaround for Muncy was bringing back the step back.
Yeah.
In the batter's box. And he used it to get him out of the slump last year, did pretty well with it, decided it wasn't right for him going into spring training for technical reasons, honestly, that escaped me. But he also said, and only one article posted this, that said it was kind of hard on his knee to do
that.
And that was the only logical reason I could think of for him not to do it. So now he does it. He's back to it. It obviously is helpful. I don't know how he or anyone else can look at it otherwise. I think unless that reporter got it completely wrong, it might be something to keep an eye on as to whether it takes a toll on his body. Otherwise, I mean, because like, why else would he have gotten rid of it in February?
Unless it's like something where, because I at least the logic that I've sort of gleaned from it is that the step back like keeps his like, I guess it's timing in order, like, or just I don't know, like during the swing, maybe not so much before, but like it sets him up better, and like maybe it was just. But yeah, I don't know. You're right. Like, why wouldn't you just do it? Like, if that was all it was. So.
I think here it is. I think assistant Pat Harris. All right, we'll keep going. If I find it, I'll find it. But
yeah. But yeah, there's a. Trying to think. That's kind of it. Like, this is weird. Okay. We haven't podcasted for like 3 weeks, and. We're just kind of catching up here. This is more of an informal podcast, but John, is there anything you wanted to plug or anything you're doing at this point that you want to sort of give a shout out to?
Yeah. I mean, my main thing is right now is slavebyvoices.substack.com. It's very me, which means it's very all over the place. You sort of have to buy into me as a writer. And I don't know if that's the best way to sell it, but like I write about tons of different things. There's a lot of baseball there, and there's a lot of pop culture, but there's also books and there's also news commentary and kind of the random stuff from Dodger Thoughts you might know me from. I'm really enjoying doing it in part because I like not being forced to write about every Dodger game as if it were critical, which is not to say I don't enjoy the Dodgers. It's just like I like doing other things. And I'd love to have more people read it. If you just sign up for a free subscription, you'll get a couple posts a week. And if you sign up for a very economically priced paid subscription, you'll get everything. It's like 5 posts a week. And I hope people will join in.
Yeah, I will say it is a very enjoyable read. You write about so many different topics, but you find a way to weave things in and why things matter, why they're important to you. I can't for the life of me remember the song, but because of one of your posts, you wrote about Bang the Drum Slowly and a specific song in that movie. And I knew about the movie, I just hadn't seen it. This was a midnight run situation. So where you wore me down and convinced me to see a great movie. And I was pleased that I did. So I went and watched that movie and it was awesome. And I loved it. And because I saw you were writing about Bang the Drum Slowly. I didn't fully read the post until I saw the movie. I just saw the opening. And then as that song came out, I said, that has to be the song John's writing about. And then I went and read it and I'm like, yeah, that's perfect. And it's very touching and moving and I enjoyed it. So like, yeah, if you hadn't written about that, I probably wouldn't have sought out Bang the Drum Slowly. So thanks for that.
So it's kind of like saving the universe.
That's right.
There's actually, I discovered there's a Bang the Drum Slowly 1 hour TV thing from the early 50s starring Paul Newman.
Oh,
before Paul Newman became Paul Newman.
Wow.
Literally from like 1952 or something. And I'm gonna watch it as soon as I can carve out the time. I'm really excited to watch that. It must have been right after the book came out.
Huh.
But I'm really looking forward to that. And yes, it was Jack Harris who wrote that the step back gave Muncy some knee pain at the end of last year. To wrap that up.
I must have missed that when it came out. So like, thanks for that too. Well, John, it's been a pleasure having you. Thanks for joining us on the podcast, and I'm sure we'll have you back at some point, but for now, that's all for us. So hope you enjoy listening. Hope you enjoy watching the Dodgers this week. We'll be back again next week with another episode. And that's all for us. Thanks for listening, everybody.